Andreas Weigel.
Thank you. Here's what I'm going to do. I also look, as everybody looks here, back what was happening, my perspective, 25 years ago, and then I even venture and think what was happening 50 years ago. Then I will talk about, since it's a university, I talk about education, my view about education, specifically in the area I'm in, AI. Then people ask me to talk a little bit about jobs. What did I do when I was a chief scientist at Amazon? And then people ask me to give some advice for the graduates here, what I think they want to consider when they are picking the job which they want to do after they graduate.
Questions also.
Great. You can interrupt me anytime. If people have questions, raise your hand, and it's not that big an auditorium. I'm very happy to reflect it back to the audience. Yes?
Yes.
What's the camera?
So what's this thing here? That.
Where's the privacy release statement?
Nothing, inappropriate here. So if you are looking here, that is Google's newest piece of AI. It's called Google Clips. And it clips, in this case, my belt. And it does AI on the chip here. The battery doesn't last very long, so I'm not sure whether we get to the talk. But at the end, I will have uploaded in the cloud, of course. I will have stories. It will pick out who the faces were, who I met. Maybe it will pick out your glasses again, because I took a picture of his glasses two days ago. It says, that is the same glasses you see 2 days ago. So basically, that here is AI at work. 1993. I was an assistant professor in computer science and cognitive science at the University of Colorado at Boulder. I was teaching the class on AI. I was teaching actually mainly the class on neural networks. And I had finished my thesis at Stanford with Dave Rumenhardt, applying neural networks for time series prediction. I was teaching computers and cognitive science. That is actually interesting because a priori, a hacker and a psychologist seem not to have that much in common. And to complicate things further, I did my degree actually in physics. So at that stage, people get confused. And I then tell them that I've started an undergrad SWE and I have a minor in philosophy. Then they think, what's this guy doing? My advice from this is, as long as you do whatever it is you're doing really well, it doesn't matter where it fits between the fields. So what I was interested in is learning from data. How can we do this, as we just learned, this exponential increase of data, and how can we make predictions of that? Whatever I could find in the world, I would put in my bag and see how I can make it useful for what I wanted to do. This is not to be confused with, what people learn in business school, which is just to talk about stuff. So it's amazing how the purpose of business schools is actually, I changed my mind on that. Because now Stanford has maid service for the students in the business school. If you need to make their bed made in the middle of the day, no problem. Why, you might be honest, wondering. Well, the purpose, I was told, is to sleep with as many people as possible during business school, so you can extort as many favors as possible down the road. Remember me? Not really. Well, it was between the psychology class and the marketing class. Yes, okay, what can I help you with? Here we are in data science, which I think is a very solid area. I was first resisting the term data science. And I do remember very distinctly that Ken Kukier, who writes for The Economist, brilliant writer, Ken came to the social data lab, which I was running at Stanford, and he talked about data science. And I said, bullshit, every science is data science, because there is no science without data. That, mind you, was before Trump, of course. It slowly evolved, and as usual, you give in, you get used to it. And over the years, the terms change. And after Halvarian actually said, data science is the sexiest job, I'm happy to be a data scientist. 93 was before Amazon was founded. Actually, exactly 25 years, Jeff Bezos was driving from New York to Seattle, coming up with his idea to start Amazon. So I don't know whether that's a long time or a short time. I guess it depends on how you measure it. But it is worth remembering that 25 years ago, there was no such thing as Amazon. If we double it, some kind of doubling, you know, which leads to 4, 8, 16 exponential. If we double it, we are in 1968, so 50 years ago. 68 was an interesting year. I vividly remember being on vacation with my parents in Denmark, and we had a radio, a transistor radio, which had two batteries. And my dad came from what's now Czechoslovakia, and we got the news that the Russian troops quashed the Czech Spring, the sort of the democracy movement, if you will, in Czechoslovakia. So that was a state of communication, to have a radio with two batteries and to be able to catch something from the air. So of course, no phones. There was very little you actually sent in terms of data. All you could do was receive data. I remember another thing from 68. That was that my dad came home one day with a box and four batteries. You know, two batteries, that was the radio, four batteries. So he unpacked it. And it was the first handheld battery-powered calculator, which did four things: add, subtract, multiply, and divide. That's, I guess, why I needed four batteries. So that was a state of the art of a, I guess, personal computer then. It was made by Sony. It cost as much in real dollars as, you know, my computer costs now. It's one of the invariants that you always pay the same amount for electronics per year. It's just you get more. You get more by exponential, by Moore's law. More by Moore's law. So, but it was about 500 euros, if they gave euros, 500 marks. Then for plus, minus, divided, in times. So what happened in the US at that time was Martin Luther King got shot. So we still had really bad segregation. White people and black people had to sit on different parts of the buses as your department was founded. You know, it's just fascinating for me, the department was founded 50 years ago, how different the world was. On the other hand, the Fair Lending Act was passed. I did my homework for this thing here. And that meant that people, customers, us, were given transparency into the data refineries. Banks are data refineries. You know, they take data, they crunch them, and they do something, like they give you a contract. Insurance are data refineries. By the way, I learned, as I was speaking at a dinner on Monday in Cologne, I learned the difference between a bank and an insurance company. The bank gives you money and takes paper. In the insurance company, you give them money and get paper. As you know, why I'm more interested in insurtech than in fintech. So the Fair Lending Act was created then. And one of the things which I also find amazing, two times since the department was born, people went to the moon. So I actually remember going downstairs to my grandparents and watching it with my own eyes on television, that there was a dude walking on the moon. And as we discussed yesterday, it really must have been a dude on the moon, because computer graphics wasn't good enough to actually, you know, do that in simulation. Now, any undergraduate, any game dev can obviously do a much better job of a moon landing than Apollo 13 did, but those days people thought people really went up to the moon before we actually had any of these things in the world which we're used to. So these are very interesting, I think, remarks if you look at 25 years and 50 years. All right, so much for the introduction. So what I am passionate about is education. And as I said, I was trained as a physicist. And before my dad came home with that box with the four batteries, we had another device at home. And I was brilliant. That had the idea of turning products into sums. Do you know how to turn a product into a sum? Yes, I love it that people said this, because most people actually have no idea what I'm talking about. Great. It was a slide ruler. So it's a logarithm, and now you can do addition, namely moving the slide and adding two things. But since it's a logarithm, you actually can do multiplication. Brilliant. And why? Because it helped people to understand orders of magnitude. Yes, it tells me 2.43, but whether it's 2.43 or 24.3 or 0243, that we had to do in our mind. One thing I hate about newspapers, maybe it's not that way in Holland, but everywhere else in the world, is that they tell you 23%. And then it's small letters, you know, of people in a survey did XYZ. Why do you start with a number? You should start with a question. I'm much more interested, and also from education, if you have people figure out what could the number be given a question, and then they look at the delta, what they thought was versus, whereas you tell them 23, because most people even don't understand that it could also be 25, or it could be 20 or 21. But that I just don't understand. Part of data literacy, of digital literacy, is to actually not start with a number, to start with a question. Now, what is a good question? My friend Danny Kahneman is the person I always go to when I don't know something. So I went to Danny last year when we had dinner and said, you know, Danny, I tell all these people and companies and workshops I do about the importance of questions, and you know, it's important to learn to ask good questions. And then I realized I actually don't know what makes a good question a good question. Do you have any idea?
That's a good question.
Yeah. He went to a good school. So a good question is a question. Danny said something like, well, a question which has the potential of an interesting answer in it, so not just yes or no. And then when we drill down a bit what interesting meant, a question which sheds light onto the underlying dimensions of the space. So a good question makes us think what the trade-offs are. So I personally believe that thinking about trade-offs, about, well, you can't, for instance, get something cheap, fast, and quick. You can get maybe two out of the three things. You get it cheap and fast, but then it will take a while, like you get it from China. Or you can get it, and so on and so forth. Or you can determine where in this three-dimensional space you want to be located. But understanding trade-offs, having questions that help you come up with trade-offs, understanding them and hopefully then coming up with an opinion, how you weigh the different axes, is important. For instance, education. My dad was a high school teacher. So what mattered to him was the left tail of the distribution. If you have the students here, the best students over there on the right and the worst on the left, he really focused on the absolute left tail. If there was one student who he could prevent from dropping out, that made his year. Not having that student fail. On the other hand, for me, who has the fortune of teaching at a couple of good universities, what I care for is who are the best students in my class. And I'm very excited about them, and I'm very, very happy to be their mentor and to help them in whichever way I can. And this is not judging. I'm not saying this is good or bad, or this is good or bad. It's just you have to know, where do you put the weights on this trade-off? It's a finite resource, your time, and I think becoming clear of what you care for. That is part of growing up. I always say making the implicit explicit is a good way of framing that. So if you have that as a rule in data science, to make the implicit explicit, there are two interpretations. One is in the spirit of the trade-off of the fitness function or the objective function, being clear what it is that you want to optimize, making it sort of implicit, I guess we want this, writing it down. That, according to my PhD advisor, is what made neural nets so successful. That in simulation, you are forced to pick a parameter. Nobody tells you whether it's two or four. Philosophers can, you know, live in the abstract and not put numbers to it. But if you simulate cognitive processes, the computer doesn't run if you don't assign a value to that variable. The other meaning of making the implicit explicit is by pattern recognition, by seeing those things that are repeated and then, you know, showing them, surfacing them, data visualization, for instance. in seeing patterns. Now, my other PhD was that Jared Friedman would have said, seeing patterns, whether they are there or not. But in hopefully in the case here of data science, seeing patterns that actually are there. Furthermore, in education and data science, there are some things which used to be important that are no longer important. I don't know about your undergrad statistics classes. I personally was extraordinarily fortunate in Karlsruhe to have stats by Professor Blunsky, who was just amazingly good. Most people are not that fortunate. And even at Amazon, we had people who, you know, they had books, you know, and then they come and they say, but is it significant? To which I always said, on the web, everything is significant. The question is it relevant? Are you asking the right question? So some of the things which were super important 100 years ago, like when you study rabbits, even rabbits only breed that fast. You really want to know, is that statement I'm making just a statistical fluctuation, or do I actually think that I found something? Data scientists are people who push on those questions. And the typical model that some manager comes and asks you, can you please run the regressions for me? You have to ask, what actually do you want? You have to understand, what problem actually are they trying to solve? And it's not really only about the problem of the question, but here's how I frame it. What decision are they trying to make? What is the value of data? The value of data is the decisions this data impacts. So once you have that mindset, you can go to that manager and debunk 90% of what they actually asked you to do. If there's no decision following up, I'm sorry, not doing it. Sort of data science means that you think about the decisions you base on this data. All right, universities. We talked about education, so let's talk about research. In the area I am in, research has largely left the universities, and not because this is not where the smart people are. This is where the smart people are. But if you just think about GDPR as the most recent example, it is very difficult to get to the data. And even if we get to data, it's very difficult to get it live data, because most data we get in academic research are dead data. Somebody hands you some data and you do your analysis and you go back to them. This is not how science works. Science is doing experiments. So we had that window in time, like when neural nets were invented, where we actually ran on data sets and trained and then had a validation set and tested it. But now we relive in a world where the relevant companies, Amazon, Google, Facebook, etc., Baidu, Tencent, depending on which hemisphere you're in, where they all actually do experiments. That's a very different attitude to have the scientific method to come up with a question, not to dead data, but to live data. This said, what do professors do in research in my field? Well, first of all, the most important thing is PR. No question about it. Publishing results. Besides PR, you need to do a little bit to get towards that. So in my area, this means you design experiments, you collect data, you analyze data, and then you write it up. That is very different from the more practical approach that you have an idea at, say, Facebook. How can I screw the customers even more and show them that ad for the fifth time? Well, if we just change one pixel in that video, we can say it's a different ad because the hash would come out differently. And the fact that they get annoyed and told me four times already, I don't want to see the ad. We said, well, you didn't see that ad. It was one pixel different the last four times. How far can you push your customers until they rebel? How far can you push Facebook? How far can the lack of integrity that you say things and you do different things go? I think we are at a very crucial moment in time right now, where a year ago I thought it was bullshit when people heard about Facebook fatigue. I took the month of May off as a Facebook vacation, and I actually didn't miss it. Quite the opposite. It was quite nice to not be bothered if the ads actually were good, then I think that would not be bad. But I'm gay, and they showed me an ad, date 50 plus women. I mean, that is a large number of women to date, particularly for a gay guy. So, I mean, if you do those ads, then please do the ads which actually I would be interested in. If that was for research, for teaching, there are six things, and I'm interested in a couple of them. First thing about teaching is you create the syllabus. You figure out how do you allocate the scarce time of the students, the attention of the students. Second, you make PowerPoints. By the way, I try to get some PowerPoints off the web because by now they say everything you can just get on the web. I tried to find a set of PowerPoints for my talk and I did not find any set of PowerPoints I could use. Third one is that you do the performance. They call it a lecture, I think. So I love that, of course, as you can tell by now. What I love even more than the performance is to animate the students, to get people to talk to each other. Then number five is you create problem sets. I hate doing that, but luckily we always outsource this to Estonia. And number six is we grade problem sets. I hate doing that, but luckily we outsource those to India, which also has the advantage that since they don't know the people, there can be no biases. So from all of that education stuff, what I enjoy is basically getting people to talk to each other. To end here, what I wanted to do, two more things very briefly. What did I do at Amazon? I basically did experiments. As a chief scientist, scientists do experiments. We came up with all kinds of experiments. And one of the things which I learned from another person is the sentence, most smart people don't work here. Which, if you think about it, is very true. As a chief scientist, your job is to talk to smart people around the world and figure out what they think. And everybody has opinions about Amazon. So I believe you. Believe me, that is the case. And then to run thousands of experiments and to figure out how people really make decisions. So that's what I did there. And everything, of course, was based on scientific method, which still is the driver for Amazon and data. And the last piece I want to talk about is advice for people here. I already said it's important that you learn what it means to do one thing well. And then don't fool yourself about being interdisciplinary. That doesn't mean that you know five things a little bit. No, just pick one thing and really know how to answer any question about it. I was very fortunate that my undergrad professors, both Julius Vess, who had in theoretical physics, who actually said, Andreas, let's just do the harmonic oscillator for the exam. The only thing you need to do is harmonic oscillator, but please, then I want to know everything about it. And the other one is in philosophy, Josef Simon, who said, well, why don't we just agree on a little booklet, Kant's Grundlegung zur Metaphysik der Sitten, and just read this little booklet, 30 pages, and just make sure you understand what's in there, and I'll ask you a couple of questions about it, which is very different from some other approaches. When I went to Stanford for my PhD, philosophy students, oh, Nietzsche, oh, we did this last week in the first hour of the class. Very different approaches. My rule is do one thing well, because that way you know actually what it means to do something well. Advice number two is people ask me, as a data scientist, should I go to a big company? Should I go to a small company? And I say, that is not the right question. The right question is, do you want to work with the people who you will work with? And for me, the microcosm you have, your boss, you know, maybe a couple of colleagues, those you see every day, that you want to make sure that you have positive vibes with them, you enjoy the discussions with them, as opposed to, you know, having reservations, you know, like, so we had reservations, but we went to the restaurant anyways. It never works out, in my experience. If you try to do something, convince yourself, yeah, it will work out in the long term. I don't like that person. I think he's an idiot. He doesn't get anything, but you know, I'll get rich. It never works out that way. So that's it. Data science changed everything. I have lots of other stories, but I think we should open it up for a few minutes for a couple of questions. I think I already told you that, to get people to ask good questions. Good question, man. So the question is, there was this paper which Facebook gave the unfortunate title, manipulation, in the title. That paper was about as innocent as anything could be. I was very surprised why people were surprised about that paper. Doing experiments is the core of any internet company. In the book, I have a few pages where I'm talking about the equivalent to an informed consent. Like, let's say you go to hospital and the doctor explains something to you, or you are part of a drug trial, then the pharma company needs to explain to you that you could be A or you could be B. It is very tricky to ask companies to do this. Just simply by the number of, as I said, I run hundreds of experiments at Amazon. If for each experiment, every person who's in one experiment, you have to actually get informed consent, that's completely undoable. That is not my problem. My problem is lack of integrity, that people don't do what they say. 2 weeks ago, Tuesday, I was at Facebook in Building 23 visiting my friend Mike. He graduated maybe 4 or 5 years ago from Stanford. Mike said, "Oh, Andreas, you know, here's the integrity group." And, you know, I already was pretty down on Facebook. I said, "So what is integrity?" "Oh, they're trying to find fake news." So if that is what integrity is for Facebook, then I'm very sad about this. But, you know, jumping next place, if you don't like this, here we have the Lean In seminar, which is, you know, Cheryl's, you know, thingy. The book is called Lean In. So they have the Lean In seminar. So I think my problem is not that they do experiments, that they learn from experiments. I want them to learn from experiments. We already had the date 50 plus women. But my problem is that they actually should say what's going on as opposed to covering up. But I hear that there's a chance that Mark Zuckerberg will be tried for perjury, for lying under oath. And we all know he only did it for us. He did not want to reveal those secrets to potentially put our share price at stake. Oh yeah, well, I forgot that.
Is
yes.
An answer you were looking for, because you were asking a good question, I think. You raised the bar for asking questions. So does it answer your question?
Yeah, but should the companies be able to publish the experiments they do if they want to?
Anybody should be able to publish anything in the aggregate. But why is it of interest at the company? The company probably couldn't care less to bother putting resources behind publishing results they found. In the book, I'm making the case that just like a subject in a drug trial, when they try out drugs, you know what I mean? I think in Holland it's different from the rest of the world. There you actually do get access to the results of the study. So I think there could be some repository. But more importantly, I think, is that when people get asked about it, that they should just say how things are, as opposed to cover them up. That is my main problem.
All right. Any other questions? Yeah. Thank you for asking in the same line. Please, everyone else, don't have any questions. So what's your question?
Very simple. You were talking about how was the data world 25 years ago.
Crazy, yeah.
And 50 years ago.
Yeah.
How do you think it's going to be in 25 years?
The good thing is that, and one of our next speakers is talking about the year 62. Oh, I got it wrong by 2 years. So I was only asked to look into the past about experience and to give advice to students. We have other people who actually are doing the job of telling us how it will be.
Answer the question.
Thank you.